Coming up on Boston Public Radio, will new recommendations about who should take cholesterol-lowering statin drugs give out-of-shape, unhealthy Americans a false and dangerous sense of security? The cardiologist answers. Then we'll go inside the Walsh for mayor campaign. Who called the shots? Was there infighting? Will what kind of candidate he was give us hints about what kind of mayor he'll be? And then it used to be called Black Friday. Now it's Black Thursday, as yet another chain announces plans to open on Thanksgiving. Are you a willing collaborator in all this?
Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory on the Olympics in Boston and a casino in Martha's Vineyard. Then we'll ask you, what are the chances of the beautiful people letting in a slots parlor? Then the conventional wisdom is that the stress of caring for an elderly relative ruins your health. Actually, not. Full details coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So I think it's safe to say that heart health is in the air. Dick Cheney is on tour promoting his book about his struggles with heart disease. The FDA just is planning to eliminate trans fats from our food. And the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology have issued the nation's first new guidelines in a decade for preventing heart attacks and stroke, which, as you probably know, calls for one-third of all adults to consider taking cholesterol-lowering statin drugs. Is this sound preventive medicine? Will cholesterol-lowering drugs give Americans an excuse to forego exercise and healthy eating? Joining us on the line to go over these new guidelines is cardiologist Dr. Tom Lee. Tom is a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, a professor at Harvard Medical School, and chief medical officer at Press Ganey. Dr. Lee is also the author of a new book, Eugene Braunwald and the Rise of Modern Medicine. Tom Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Hi, Dr. Lee. So for people who haven't read this, tell people what exactly the recommendations are for these cholesterol-stopping drugs.
Well, on one hand, the guidelines may look more complicated now, but in a sense, they're really simpler. They're really moving toward, let's treat the patient, let's not treat the number. So what they're saying is, let's not think everyone is the same. Let's figure out who is at higher risk, and let's use statins in those patients. Statins lower risk by about one-third in anyone. So if you have more than a modest risk for heart disease, let's find out and let's put you on a statin.
And when we read numbers this morning, Dr. Lee, that say that roughly 50% of white men, 60% of African-American men in their 50s would now fall into these high-risk category of people who'd be treated with statins, what kind of it's shocking to me. Is it to you?
Well, on one hand, it's shocking, and it's actually the numbers can be even more extreme if you actually get in to use the calculator, which is it's a lot simpler than signing up for health insurance on the government exchange, but it's you do have to download the spreadsheet and plug in numbers. And what you find out quickly is that everyone, virtually everyone over the age of 70 who expects to live 10 years should probably be on a statin according to these recommendations. What's changed is we're living a long time. You know, we're living into 80s, 90s, and beyond. So the impact of something that lowers your risk for a heart attack or a stroke by a third, it's much greater than it was in the era when people were dying in their 50s, 60s, 70s.
You know, Dr. Lee, when I listen to you, I have to say it's very soothing and convincing. But before I listen to you, I listened to Dr. Sanjay Gupta last night on CNN, and he was actually sounding an alarm. Here is Sanjay Gupta from last night.
We have pretty good strategies at preventing a lot of these problems in the first place with some basic things, you know, just the better diets, exercise, all the things that I've talked about for years. The fact that we're going in the opposite direction, the fact that 70 million people may be on these drugs in the next couple of years, it's a bit mind-numbing, actually. And I feel like in some ways people are waving the white flag a bit on this whole issue of obesity, heart disease, diabetes, stroke, everything.
And in addition to that, it seems to me, as a corollary thought, it has potential to create a false sense of security in people who are not terribly healthy or not taking care of themselves. Isn't that a fair criticism of this move?
Well, it is a fair criticism, and it's it cuts both ways, because there was a false sense of security created with the old approach, which is you just treat cholesterol to get to some number, and then you could declare victory. I actually think now we have to all think about our risk and all do everything we can to lower our risk. I'm all for diet and exercise, and, you know, and God forbid that you're still smoking, get rid of those cigarettes of today. But in addition, there is one more thing that you can do. You can go to a vegetarian diet and live like a hunter-gatherer from the caveman days, and you won't have atherosclerosis. Or you can take a statin if you meet the criteria that suggests that your risk is more than 7.5% of an event over the next 10 years. Most people, you know, under the age of 60 or 70 are not going to be over 7.5%, but a lot of people are. It is still the most common reason for dying. And so, of course, a lot of people are going to benefit from it.
We're talking with Dr. Tom Lee, a physician at Brigham and Women's and a professor at Harvard Medical School. You know, I can't help being a little bit suspicious here, Dr. Lee, when you read that even though these members did not vote on these specific documents, that half the members of this 15-member advisory panel have ties, financial ties, to these statin drug makers. And that makes me a little suspicious.
Well, you know, and I think it's good to ask that question, and it's good for them to ask that question. And I can tell you, I have no ties to any pharmaceutical company at all. And so I think, and I don't even take these drugs myself. I can tell you my personal risk on the calculator is 3.9%. And when my birthday comes in a month, my risk will jump up to 4.4%. I do think that these experts on this group, I think they took their responsibilities very, very seriously. I've read the report. It's a very thoughtful document.
Okay.
And I think that statins are pretty safe drugs. No drug is 100% safe. But the risk of these drugs is low. In many countries, they don't even bother bringing people back for blood testing, like we tend to do in the U.S. every 6 months. So I actually think that if the medications are priced low, as they are now that they're generic, it's a good calculation that they're making.
And the other big criticism that I've read, too, is that women were not well represented in these clinical trials. It was mostly men. So and women obviously die of heart disease, too. And that, you know, there are some minor side effects here, the muscle ache thing and the tiny risk, supposedly, of irreversible muscle destruction. But those are issues as well. The women and the tiny side effects, they're there.
Yes, and you know, and I think that there are more and more questions as you go deeper that, you know, the things aren't perfect. Like, I'm a Chinese American, and there aren't that many Chinese in these trials at all. And Chinese have lower heart attack rates than Caucasians. And so you have to wonder, you know, that there are more Chinese than any other kind of people in the world, practically. And you have to wonder, well, what about them?
Yeah.
That said, I think that, you know, there is a reasonable amount of data on women showing that they benefit from statins. And I think it's safer to assume that the same principles apply to women than to not do anything under the assumption that nothing's proven, so let's do nothing.
Dr. Lee, let's for just 1 second get back to what I started talking about a minute ago, that people will, you know, a la Sanjay Gupta, people take the easy way out. I mean, imagine you're sitting across from a typical patient of yours where the second most overweight nation on the planet, after being supplanted by Mexico. I know the obesity rate in kids is just abhorrent, that sort of thing. Why are you confident? Is it because you trust that patients will trust you? Why are you confident that people won't take the easy way out based upon America's recent history with healthy eating and exercise? Why won't they just say, I hear you, Dr. Lee, I'll do that exercise next month, but today I'm going to start taking the pill?
Well, you know, and I can't guarantee that they won't, but if they do, they're being foolish, because, you know, being fit and keeping your weight under control, they have many other benefits besides reducing your risk for heart attack and stroke. They reduce your risk for diabetes, for example. And, you know, diabetes is a tough disease. You know, when you get damage to your nerves, you get damage to your blood vessels, you get, You know, having your feet numb and burning all the time because of diabetes or developing kidney failure from diabetes, that's not pleasant. So, you know, there's plenty of reason to, you know, continue that have nothing to do with today's report to try to be fit and to and certainly, you know, no one should be smoking cigarettes. You know, anyone who thinks, oh, I can now smoke because I'm going to take a statin to offset my cardiovascular risk, is really being very, very foolish.
You know, that's going to be a cartoon on the cover of The New Yorker. You know, it is
right.
A guy smoking a cigarette and then popping
the
a couple of statins.
So, doctor, bottom line is you feel pretty good about these new recommendations.
I think that they're in advance. It's the logical progression intellectually. You know, we're now treating, we're not assuming patients are all the same. We're treating patients, we're not treating test results. I also would emphasize, though, that we're never done reducing risk. It can always be lower, and that's why, you know, whether or not you take one of these drugs, you should be exercising. You should be keeping your weight under control, all those things that Dr. Gupta referred to. And then banning smoking from your life, you know, nothing does as much for you as that.
Dr. Tom Lee, before you go away, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. I know we mentioned that you're the author of a new book, Eugene Braunwald and the Rise of Modern Medicine. I think I'm embarrassed to ask, who is Eugene Braunwald?
Well, Eugene Braunwald is, you know, he is an 84-year-old icon of medicine who lives right here in Boston. He's, you know, a professor at Harvard and at the Brigham, and he is responsible in the second half of the 20th century for really showing you could change things in cardiology, that you can reduce death rates from heart attacks, you can reduce heart failure. Before 1950 or so, medicine was very passive. You would just witness what was happening and predict the future, but you couldn't change the future. And so this book is about how this immigrant from chased out of Europe by the Nazis helped change the culture of medicine to make it an active, aggressive field that you know, leads to discussions like the one we're having today.
Congratulations.
That sounds like a fantastic
book. Thank you,
Doctor. Doctor, thanks for taking the time to be with us. We much appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Dr. Tom Lee is a physician at Brigham and Women's and a professor at the Harvard Medical School and chief medical officer at Press Ganey. He's also the officer of the book Jim just mentioned, Eugene Braunwald and the Rise of Modern Medicine. And to hear more from him, tune in this Friday. He's going to be a contestant, Jim, on our Friday news quiz.
I bet you'll do quite well.
I think he will. Maybe we can get sort of a personal diagnosis when he comes in. On Friday, we want to ask you guys at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, what do you think about this? Is this a great thing, a cause for celebration? Or does this mean that we are now the second fattest nation on earth, as we know, Mexico has surpassed us, but are we just going to continue to take the easy way out, keep eating the bad food, keep not exercising? We have a serious, obviously, weight problem in the United States of America. Now you're just going to say, hey, I'll get my statin drug and not worry about it and keep on my bad habits. 877-301-8970. You know, I'm not a physician, obviously.
I love when you do this, by the way. I'm not an architect.
I'm not an architect. I'm not an economist.
Fine. What are you?
I'm just a person.
Okay, fine. And your point
this
is?
This gives me the creeps.
It gives
me the creeps. The idea that we're going to have, you know, massive millions of people, 70 million people taking these drugs. And they always say, I know that they say statins are one of the safest drugs, and I'm sure that they are. But, you know, I always love these commercials on TV when you say, well, you take this drug here. Now, you may, you know, your toes may fall off, your head may turn around backwards.
Well, but in all fairness, they say the side effects of statins are very modest compared to the side effects of lots of other drugs.
Increases the risk of muscle aches and a small risk of irreversible muscle destruction. I would still argue that if you'd be better off losing the weight, going on to the Mediterranean diet, than worried about muscle destruction.
But that's
what does that mean? You want to pick up your arm, your left arm, your right arm?
The bottom line, obviously, any sane person would say they'd prefer exercise and healthy eating. The question is that what people are going to do? And my sense is, you think if the average person was told, listen, you can eat anything you want, take this to an extreme, anything you want, you can never exercise, I've got a pill that's going to keep you heart attack free, My fear is the average person, and probably more often than not, I would fall into that category. I take the pill. 877-301-8970. I am totally in the Sanjay Gupta category here. He's not a bomb thrower either, by the way. I mean, he is a generally fairly cautious physician, but he said that bite we just played, he said unequivocally last night on television, this is a risky thing. It gives people a real false sense of security and a dangerous false sense of security, because the evidence would suggest that if you have Dr. Tom Lee sitting across from you at your doctor's office, I think the odds are pretty good he's going to convince you this is either an interim thing or a thing you should try to avoid. I think the average person who reads this report today, who watches the evening news, who listens to us, wants to go to the buffet for the 11th time rather than just 10, doesn't want to go to the Y tomorrow morning, is going to say, this is a solution. You know what they're going to say? And since you've never had a weight problem, and I have, I will tell you what the solution is. I'm going to take the statins for a month. And then next month, what day is today? A month from today, I'm going to start going to the gym. So yeah. 1 month, and then, well, wait a second. Well, it's Christmas. I can't, obviously,
can't do it during Christmas.
During Christmas.
All those parties.
And then it's
all
January, and I gain 17 pounds. What's 17 pounds? 877-301-8970. Do you have the same worries? Will Americans, on average, I know there's some exceptions to all rules, will we take the easy way out? And I fear that we will.
Well, it's also the whole thing with a lot of medicine in the United States of America. It's about taking the pills in general. You know, we talk about this mental health. Obviously, that's very different than heart disease and hardening your arteries and all that. But that's the easy solution, that your doctors see you for such a short amount of time. You're in, you're out. That's a way to tackle the problem instead of going for the overall issues.
It's easier.
The stress
Forget seeing
in
your
life.
Doctor briefly. It's easier.
Or the stress in your life. I mean, we talk about this all the time. How many people are just stressed out to the max, and how does that affect everything else in your life? You know, you don't go to the doctor, and it's very rare the doctor will say, so how's your stress level? You know, what are the stressors in your life? Are you, we're going to be talking about this later on, are you taking care of your elderly parents? Do you have kids with physical problems? So it's just take the pill. And I've always been suspicious of pills, and I'm sure this is fine, although we just got an emailer who says there's some issues with liver function with these statin drugs. I have no idea if that's correct. I mean, they didn't say that in the paper this morning. It was about muscle problems, but still, these are big time drugs. They change your whole system.
Let's go at 877-301-8970. We want to get your 2 cents on this. Let's go down the list of the primary things you can do instead of taking a statin drug to lower your cholesterol. You can lose weight, which is not the easiest thing in the world. You can reduce your stress level. Very difficult to do. Would you not agree? Get active means a lot of exercise, no more cigarettes. Obviously, people are trying to quit for the most part, and lower your alcohol consumption. So let's go down the list. Lower your stress, lower your alcohol consumption, dump the cigarettes that you apparently are addicted to, eat less and exercise, or take a pill that may be a solution to your problems. You know, at least a fix for your problems. Those numbers that were in the newspaper this morning that I read to Dr. Lee a couple of minutes ago, 50% of white men and 60% of African-American men who are 50 or older, which, again, in the current day is not terribly old, is a staggering, staggering number.
877-301-8970 is the number. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. Christopher points out that sometimes you have an inherited predilection for high cholesterol, and the diet and exercise is not going to change it. He says he's been on statins for years with absolutely no problem. And that is true. If you hear about people that are young and they're thin and they're eating well and they still have high cholesterol problems. So, I mean, if you're one of those people, but one of the concerns is that if you come into these categories of people with a higher risk, that you're going to wind up getting these drugs even if you don't have high cholesterol yet and you have no signs of heart disease. 877-301-8970. Let's take some phone calls here. You ready? Let's go to Doug in Boston. What do you think, Doug?
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Hey, Doug.
Well, I'd like to share a personal experience with that. My wife, a couple of years ago, she's 52, by the way, was told by her doctor that she has high cholesterol. So what she did was she researched, rather than immediately jumping to the statin solution, she researched how using diet she could possibly lower her cholesterol. And she found an item called red yeast rice, which is available in most of the world. However, thanks to the pharmaceutical company's lobbyists, in the American government, they managed to put the kibosh on selling red yeast rice in the United States. And their premise was, because she looked into that, was that you can't control the quantity of red yeast rice that a person would eat.
So wait a minute. This is red yeast rice.
Correct.
Okay.
And that is a natural statin. Works very, very well. And that might, in fact, be why some of the other people in other countries have lower cholesterol ratings, because they can eat these kind of things naturally. But our government is making sure that we can't get red yeast rice here in this country. The only time you can get it, it's already been processed to remove the statins from it.
Well, you know,
did she find it, Doug, somehow?
She actually had to buy it through Canada.
God.
She went on the black market to get red yeast rice. Doug, thanks for the call. You know what? Even let's assume it were more easily available. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Doug's retelling is a perfectly accurate one. I assume it is. It's harder to do. Even if it was available on your health food shelf, it is harder to do. What do most Americans do? And I am the worst example of this more often than not. We take the easiest path to a fix or a cure. And a statin is still an easier fix or a cure, even if the drug companies allegedly were not standing in the way of this natural
Doug
thing.
Doug brings up another problem with this for me is the financial incentives of financing drugs as opposed to financing non-expensive.
Did you hear what Dr. Lee said to you?
Yes, he did. He said he had no financial ties to anything and he did not think that was an issue. And in fairness, we should point out that the people who did have the financial ties to these different drug companies were not allowed to vote on the documents, but still many of the members that were on the advisory panel did have ties to those drug companies. So let's go to Mike in someplace in Massachusetts. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hey.
My take on the interview, the data, the recommendations, all that, my take on it is that no part of that conversation with Dr. Lee suggested that it was an either-or scenario. There, at no time did he say anything like, take these drugs instead of
said the opposite. The best course is eating carefully and exercising.
Precisely. So I think that the data, the recommendations come from just the reality that the American public in general is not doing a good job, choosing the right foods for their bodies and maintaining their health in an appropriate way for longevity. And that's all it is. It's just these recommendations because folks are not taking care of themselves, and this will prolong their lives even though they're not taking care of themselves.
Yeah, but Mike, let me put your statement another way. Since we essentially should give up because we've done such a horrible job of taking care of ourselves, so let modern medicine do the second best thing. That's what you're saying, right?
Well, I think that that's what people are doing. I wouldn't ever recommend that. I'm fit.
Oh, I understand.
40. But, folks are taking care of themselves, and this will help them live longer. It's not necessarily even a good thing, but it is scientifically so.
Yeah, Mike, I think your point is factually accurate. It's just I hope you'd agree that it's troubling that that is the state of affairs, and that is why people will rush to, I think, embrace these recommendations. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Beth in JP. Beth, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call.
Hi, good afternoon. Love your show. Listen as often as I can.
Thank you, thank you.
My father-in-law has been taking statins for many, many years, and had difficulty walking, was having muscle weakness. He went to doctors for about three years, the best doctors in New England, couldn't find anything. Finally decided that it was because of his statins. But for 3 years, they told him that statins wasn't, a cause of what was going on. So he can barely walk now. And I just want to make people aware that even though the risks are small, when you do have a problem with a statin, with muscle weakness, it ruins one's life. So people should just be aware of that before they take it. It's not such a you know, it's not something you should just take without thinking about it first or talking to your doctor.
By the way, Beth, did they make a clear connection between the statin and your father-in-law's condition?
Well, they finally took him off and said that it would take a couple of years for him to get his muscles. They said it was reversible, probably.
And? So.
Well, it's only been about 7 or 8 months.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know, Beth, I'm getting emails from people saying almost the exact same thing you're saying. One is from Colette, who said her parents just stopped taking their statins because of the side effects, leg pains. They could not even sleep at night. The leg pains were so terrible. Her father's a physician and her mother's a nurse, and they were getting leg pains at night, and they were getting leg pains during the day, and they stopped. So it's a similar situation. That's what they do say, that statins do increase the risk of muscle aches with a small risk of irreversible muscle destruction. So, you know, I mean, no drug is without a side effect.
Yeah, but Beth, thanks for the call. My fear is no matter how expansive the information on side effects is, I'm not sure what the law is, but I think the law is pretty close to the fact that you have to spend as much time on these television commercials talking about the side effects as you do about the I mean, 60 Minutes is essentially 20 minutes of reporting now and 40 minutes of drugs for older people.
But the reality is,
does that stop anybody from taking most of these drugs?
I don't think so. You read these things, you hear these things, and then they list the 9,000 things you might die of if you take this drug.
My sense is if they have the money to advertise, people are ignoring the downside and embracing the upside. One more quick one. Michael, you're on Pawtucket, Rhode Island. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Yes, hello. I have been a statin patient for about a half a dozen years. My doctor had recommended it to me, and it has to do with the numbers. And my numbers have increased, have decreased rather, but not rapidly enough. And so recently the doctor increased the dosage. So I've gone from a 10 milligram to a 20 milligram. And in fact, I've started having some of those leg difficulties just in the last time period, but haven't talked to the doctor about it. But my question overall is, and I spoke to your questioner about this, is how do they work? I don't see any details. It seems to me that they don't even really understand how statins function in the body.
We're surely not going to be able to answer
that. I have no idea.
Dr. Lee is back on the quiz on Friday. We'll ask. Before we let you go, though, Michael, are you doing the other things, trying to eat more carefully, doing exercise?
Yes.
So essentially you're doing both.
Yes, and I see it as like I have always seen it until this recent issues as just an insurance policy.
That's good.
Kind of a medical insurance policy that was recommended by the doctor, given my the level of cholesterol that I had, my family background of some heart problems in the family over the years, so my odds were higher, and with the other things, the diet and exercise, it did produce the expected
result. Well, I should say, it sounds to me you're doing it the right way. And I mean, the perfect example. Michael, thank you much for the call. We appreciate
it. That is one of the points in the story, that many people who have, for whatever reason, high cholesterol cannot deal with it only by diet and exercise.
So but at least he's trying, which is, I think, the optimum situation.
At least he's trying. Okay. When we come back, we're going to find out the secrets behind the Marty Walsh campaign for mayor and its success. An insider's view next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Marty Walsh defied conventional wisdom that John Connolly would be the hands-down front-runner in the mail race. Of course, part of Walsh's success was that he was a really strong candidate. But what good is a strong candidate if he has a weak campaign? Here with us in Studio 3 is the David Plouffe or the David Axelrod, or maybe the chief intern of the Marty Walsh campaign, political consultant Michael Goldman. He's here to give us a lowdown on what made the Walsh campaign work from the inside. Michael, good to see you. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Did we win?
Yeah, you did.
Still waiting for results.
You did.
Oh, thank you.
Well, let's start an election night and then work backwards, Michael Goldman. When was that golden moment that you knew Marty Walsh was going to be the next mayor?
I'm so sorry. I should have shut this off.
He's getting a phone call by Marty Walsh from
Turks and
Caicos.
Turks and Caicos, yeah. He's
this is totally true. Michael Goldman has left the studio.
Okay. Well,
here he is. He's
back.
This is the first time it's happened in our 9 months or 10 months at WGB. That's the life of a political consultant.
I'm not saying who it was, but it was an office holder.
Unnamed office holder.
What were you saying, Marjorie?
No, I just want to say I went on that Turks and Caicos website, for about 45 minutes, and man, we should all be in Turks and Caicos.
I was embittered when I was not invited to go with him.
Spectacular. But so let's get, we're going to work backwards. Right. Election night. When did you know? Marty Walsh was going to be the next mayor?
Well, despite a lot of the stuff that's been out there, we were comfortable all day. Early on, there was this increase in precincts, which normally would be good for John Connolly. So what we call the first wave, the 10 o'clock wave, showed higher than expected numbers from those areas. By 3 o'clock, everything had come back exactly the way we wanted it to come back. It was exactly where we expected it to be. Marty himself basically made the call to go from targeted polls, meaning people we had ID'd, to a broad poll, and we pulled them out. And so I never thought we were in trouble in that way. When I knew for sure was when I was downstairs on the floor of the ballroom, and I was trying to find out what precincts had come in, and we got numbers, but we had no precincts, so we didn't know where they were from. And so finally I yelled upstairs and said, "Has Savin Hill come in yet?" And they said no. And I turned to Allison King and said, "We won.
Thank you.
We won." And she said it. And then, to my great surprise, the next day, every station used me. But the best part of that story was after she announced that Michael Goldman of the Walsh campaign thinks that they have enough votes to win, she turned to me and said, "What if you're wrong?" And I said to her, "Hell, I'm old anyway. Who's going to remember 5 years?"
Now, Michael, I want to take you back to the beginning of the campaign. Do you have any calls to make before I do?
Something? Your property taxes weren't going to go up till just now.
How did your relationship with Marty start? And also the whole inner circle, the Joyce Linehans, the Tom Keatys, the key players. Right. How did you all get brought in?
Well, and I appreciate the opportunity to come in. The three people who really deserve the most credit in this campaign, besides Marty Walsh himself, who was a spectacular candidate, as you guys know, having dealt with him, were Joyce Linehan, were Tom Keaty, and were Mattie O'Neill. They met with Marty back in late March when the mayor looked like he might, in fact, not run. Marty had not intended to run against the mayor if he ran. And they met in a room with a couple of other people.
At his request, he called the three of them.
People
in.
They knew, people he had relationships with. And with all due respect, and this is peace has been lost, as often happens, if one were to take a look as a consultant from the outside looking in at the original field, sans Menino doesn't run.
Right.
So the first, you have to give John Connolly the edge. He'd been out there running for 4 months. I really believe that a woman of color was going to be a dramatic candidate, and we know we ended up with Charlotte Goldrichie. We had a DA with huge amounts of money, Dan Connolly. We had a Hispanic candidate in a growing Hispanic city with labor support in Felix. Then you had Marty Walsh. And even some people put Rob Consalvo ahead of Marty Walsh, who was a perfect profile of Menino.
Right.
So you're talking about a guy who nobody really thought had a shot. In part, and rightly so, from a political consulting point of view, because he came from a small, tiny sliver of the city.
So what was the conclusion after that meeting with those three people you mentioned, Keaty, O'Neill, and Linehan,
and
with
Marty,
obviously? What was Walsh's conclusion at the end of that
meeting?
Let's
put on a campaign. Let's just
that run. It was doable.
It was doable, and nobody got paid from that group, and nobody from that group ever got paid, actually. And I was like Ringo Starr, even much later in the mix, and it was a phenomenal group to work with.
What's your Marty connection? How did you get
actually,
pulled in this?
As you both know, my wife is a social worker, and I knew Marty because he had, despite what the press always pushed on the labor, his big issues were always human services issues, alcohol, drugs, mental health. He had been very important when I was involved 10 years earlier in the gay marriage issue. Arlene Isaacson wrote an impassioned piece, as you both know, Arlene, a big advocate, saying that
gay marriage, gay civil rights bill, all the things.
And I was actually surprised when I first talked to Marty about doing the race, and you know what I considered to be my vision of how to run a race when you're an insurgent candidate with a lot of people to pass. And what I liked about him were two things. Number one, he said to me, you know, I'm running to run. I'm not running to hide. I want to, be really aggressive. I want to be out there, And number two, which was kind of interesting, was he really had a self-confidence that belied his actual position at that point. I mean, all of these people, Joyce, Maddie, Tom, they got in this race because they loved Marty Walsh, and they really thought that Marty Walsh, if he could get a chance to make his case, could make his case. And when people have said to me, how did he win? I always answer the question, in the end, how he won is he, of all the candidates, answered the three fundamental questions of campaigns like this. Does the candidate understand the problems of people like me? Does he care about the problems of people like me? And will he do something for me, my family, my community, my city? And I think when you take a look at, for example, David Paleologos' public polling and other public polling, you see that those are the questions in which he really beat John Connolly. John Connolly did better in education. They split on a lot of other issues.
But Michael, wasn't that where Marty Walsh benefited not only by his own behavior in the campaign, but by some of the independent expenditures that he decried, like at our debate? No, let me get it out for a second for those who don't remember. When that campaign literature, which he asked to stop after it came out, saying he's the product of elite, meaning John Connolly, here's the working class hero, that began to frame the narrative that essentially led people to that, and that opened them up to believing Marty Walsh was who you say
he
is.
I don't agree with that, Jim.
Why?
I think that narrative started getting written before, in a discomforting way, quite frankly. I think that Marty did not press the issue of the fundamental differences between him and Connolly. The media was looking to create a race, as they ought to do, and they're looking for fundamental differences. And because there were no fundamental differences on issues, big issues, I mean, they both favored charter schools, they both favored school reform, they both were basically progressive guys, although Marty, I think, was more progressive. They both had records that were pretty good records that couldn't be beaten up on. And so the media, in their attempt, and this is their job, to say, let me tell you the difference, they hooked on Marty's story, and that was the cancer, that was the alcohol, and the 18 years of sobriety, and to a greater degree, they never wrote about his human services stuff, which might have hurt us, actually, and they wrote about the labor stuff because that's what Connolly was pushing. He was the teacher.
Can we get back to the inside? I'm sorry, Marty.
But the one thing I think, I wonder if you, Marty Walsh outspent John Connolly significantly in this race with outside money. If you were John Connolly's advisor, would you have told him to take the money that he
absolutely
refused to take?
But beyond that, I mean, you have to remember, and again, this is one of the great the reason you do shows like this is to sort of put the record, the history in order. When the original question of taking what are called independent expenditure, i.e. money, came up, Marty said if everyone said they weren't going to do it, he wouldn't do it. And that's where it stood until Charlotte Golarichi got in and Emily's list came in. And our presumption was that they were going to raise huge amounts of money. So five of the 10 candidates, including John Connolly, said, we're not going to not take money if she's going to take the money. And that's how that all started. The funny part is because
she ended up with $500 from Emily's list.
But who knew?
At the time, crushed money-wise.
And we also believed, and I thought it was true, that Stand for Children, which has every right to contribute, because that's what the Supreme Court said, was going to fund him. He made a determination, I believe.
He being John Connolly,
that he did not need that money to beat Marty Walsh. I think that with all due respect, I really do believe that they thought that Marty Walsh was going to be, and they told reporters. I mean, Marjorie, I don't know if they told you.
This has been written John Connolly thought he could beat Marty Walsh. He was worried about Charlotte Golarichi,
right, and also worried about Consalvo because of the relationship.
Right.
But and to that point, on the night that we won the preliminary, the surprise upset of the preliminary, reporters came over to our place afterwards, having been to John Connolly's, and off the record basically said that the Connolly people were thrilled to have Marty Walsh and would wipe the floor with them. And I wrote those words in a piece of paper and put it in my wallet. And on election night when we beat him, I ripped him up.
Why? Because he was another white Irish guy?
Because there are two reasons why. Number one, I think that there was a bit of a class thing on the other side, that they looked at Marty Walsh and saw a blue-collar, three-decker Dorchester guy, and they looked at themselves and they said, he can't beat us. But I also think historically they weren't wrong. If you go back and take a look to 1967, Louise Day Hicks comes out of the Southie Dorchester base, wins the primary against Kevin White, loses the election. She tries 4 years later, she loses again. Joe Timmeldy comes out of the Dorchester, same base. He wins the primary, loses the election twice. Most recently, Flaherty. Jimmy Brett, Davis Mullins. And they thought that there was no way for a candidate from that base to link to another part of the city. As you and Jim know, the Flynn phenomenon was really in 1983, and you were both here for that.
We were.
Was his linking of South Boston with Ray Dooley's Austin Brighton Sandinista guys. And they didn't, nobody
Ray
saw.
Ray Dooley became his chief of staff and died a very young death in Ireland.
Michael, so it makes sense that they would think that, geez, this is another guy. We're gonna frame him as a blue-collar, three-decker, too conservative, and we'll win.
We're talking to Michael Goldman, key player in the Marty Walsh campaign, and he actually worked for Louise Day Hicks back in the 60s, so he knows. Let's go back inside.
We dated. We didn't. I didn't remember. We just were dating.
Was there infighting? Truth be told here. Was there infighting amongst the... I mean, every winning campaign, there's infighting. Who's in charge? Is this the right strategy? Was there any of that stuff?
I got to tell you, among the four people that I... The three people I mentioned, myself, I never had a bad day. It was the most amazing thing. I used to think to myself, I lucked out falling into the race, essentially, later than they did. But there was a real sense that this was something that was doable, that it was going to be hard, and that we're all in the same boat together.
How about when Doug Rubin worked for Arroyo, and everybody knows he worked for Deval Patrick, for Elizabeth Warren, for Joe Kennedy. Now he's working for Martha Coakley. Pretty big name in Massachusetts politics. When he, after his candidate Arroyo lost and he got involved in this, did that create division, new kid involved in the campaign?
I had one. Marty asked me the question. They came in. They were generous, came in for nothing. They came in. They worked. And I'll take to win. I'll take help from the devil if I have to. And they were did a good job, and they helped enormously with the implementation. I wish I could tell you tales out of school, but the normal kind of give and take, we came so far so fast. I mean, even if you take a look at look at David Paley Logos's Boston Herald numbers.
Yep. Who was right on the money, by the way, right before
almost
the election.
To the point.
But before the preliminary, when he actually had us losing the preliminary by 4 points, he ran head-to-heads with Marty versus John Connolly, John Connolly versus Goloruchy, John Connolly versus Consalvo, and one other, John Connolly versus Conley. And he had us 17 points behind. So we had 5 weeks to gain 17 points. We gained 20. It was unexpected in the way that upsets are often unexpected.
You know, Michael, also, one last thing about inside for a second. What was it like to work for Walsh? What was he like as a candidate? I told Marjorie this story this morning. I've told her before. When last campaign I ran was John O'Connor for Congress.
Incredibly successful.
Happy 101, yeah, very successful. He's a wonderful guy. Another guy died a horrible early death. But I remember John was so impossible to work with, and I mean this in a loving way, that about three nights before the election, he literally threw one of his cell phones. This is a true story because his driver told me, threw the cell phone that I would call him in into the Charles River so that he did not have to take my calls.
There are a lot of people who could appreciate that.
I can understand that, Jim.
But what is Walt? I mean, he seems to be, we said this to him on the radio, sort of a no-drama kind of guy. What was he like to work with as a candidate?
Two very quick things. Number one is the only time I ever saw him get angry was when he found out about the piece that the National Union had sent out, the IE, without his knowledge. We had run a campaign, as you guys know.
Wait, the one that we asked him about in the second debate?
Independent expenditure.
Oh, okay.
The one that you guys asked about. People don't understand how seriously we and the other campaigns took the IE separation. They could not tell
us. Meaning by law, for those who don't know. There can be no coordination, even conversation between these the independent expenditure committees and the candidate, him or herself.
And the press, quite frankly, always thinks that it's a wink-wink deal. And it's not, because this is serious stuff. People go to jail over this, and no one was going to Danbury for this race And we did not know that piece was coming. We were shocked when it dropped. He called right away and basically through sources said to them, I don't want this to happen again. We had no idea and couldn't know that they had already mailed the second piece that morning. So while we were getting assurances that it would not happen again, in the mail was the second drop, which Connally used to batter us. If you think about it, that was the only mistake of the campaign, and it wasn't our mistake. It was the we were winning the campaign by running the campaign we wanted to win, and we ended up running that campaign. John Connally did exactly what he should have done. He tied Marty Walsh to it and made it seem like it was a Marty Walsh piece, even though, with all due respect, he and we both knew.
But Jim must have been thrilled. I remember the debate here was at 7 o'clock at night, the one Jim and I moderated. I came back, went home to take a shower, came back at 4 o'clock. At 4 o'clock, the streets were packed with guys with Marty Walsh signs. You must have been happy about that. You had a huge presence.
No question about it. Everywhere we went. But that's separate from this piece of literature.
So what was the second thing he was angry about?
He wasn't. That was the only thing, the only time. And, of course, when the second piece dropped on Tuesday, right before your debate, and we were not aware that they had sent out a release that said we're no longer going to do this.
But he was
and
never angry at you guys. Forget never, angry at the world. Never angry at
And I'll give you a better one
than
that
one. I think
it's
that serenity prayer, the AA serenity prayer.
You know what?
Prayer.
I've been with him, luckily, at 6 in the morning. I've been with him at 2 in the morning. He is exactly what you see. He is that way all the time. He is the most in control in terms of just keeping it level that I've ever seen. 45 years I've been knowing this, guys. But I'm going to tell you the great Marty Walsh story I've been telling people.
We're ready.
Nobody knows except the few people I've told it to. It was the next morning. We didn't know whether we were going to come in first or second in the preliminary. But we knew if we came in second, we had to drive the media that next day. And if we came in first, we had the bonus. So we had set up an old-fashioned meet at 6 a.m. at Savin Hill Station to greet people. So a miracle of miracles. We win the primary because the field is so terrific, the preliminary. And we don't sleep all night. I go home. I change. I come back. It's 5:30 in the morning. No one has slept, obviously. And we start to walk up to Savin Hill. And to my shock, and you guys will appreciate this, there aren't two or three cameras. There are seven cameras lined. I mean, like the old days, like the 70s, for God's sakes. And everyone's like patting on the back. Meanwhile, Marty's walking up the hill, and the people he knows, he said, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you. I hope you got it to vote. To the people he didn't know, he said, hi, I'm Marty Walsh. I'm running for mayor. I hope you'll consider me in November. That's not even. I get up to the thing. I'm shaking hands with reporters. We have the bank set up. And I look out of the corner of my eye, and I see a homeless person asleep inside the station, right in the line of my shot. So now I'm thinking to myself, I'm on adrenaline. I'm thinking, how do I move him without the press seeing me move? Because that's my job, right? So I take out a $20 bill. I roll it up in my hand, and I have it in my hand. I'm waiting for the the press to be somewhat distracted. Marty walks up, starts shaking hands to the cameraman, all of whom are in unions, and so they love him. And he goes to turn to go to the thing, and he sees the guy lying down. And he walks over to the guy. No one can hear him. He bends over. I went home that night and I said to my wife, I said, I just found out tonight why I'm going to hell and he's going to heaven. And she said, what? I said, I was going to give the guy $20 to move. You know what Marty said to him? She said, what? He said, hi, I'm Marty Walsh. I'm running for mayor. I hope you'll consider me in November. Now, you can't make that up. It's not. That's not something that's fake. It's not something that's. It's an amazing
thing. I spoke to that guy. He voted for Connally.
Well, you know what? You know what? Wouldn't surprise me.
That is a great story. You did tell me that before. One last quick question. It was a big deal to get Charlotte Gola Ritchie because she came in third. And previous to that, you're getting Arroyo and Barros, the three guys, big vote getters of color. Not three guys. She's a woman, obviously. How hard was it to get Charlotte Gola Ritchie? I heard that Marty Walsh is over there at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning.
He's told the story. So, I mean, she was very – they were all, believe it or not, and I've heard again from reporters saying, what did they want? And what they wanted was their issues heard. They wanted him to absorb a lot of their ideas about the new Boston, which he had already done, and they knew that. When people said to me – there are two parts of that. When people said to me, why did they choose him? And again, my failure, I could never get a reporter to write the story I want them to write, which said that people who knew John Connally and Marty Walsh best, liked them both, worked with them both, campaigned with them both, they all went with Marty. What are they telling you? And somehow, because it didn't go to the narrative, in play that really never got the attention it deserved. But I'll tell you, we ended up, meaning the campaign, through, and this is all Marty Walsh, every woman in the city of Boston elected who endorsed, everyone endorsed him, every person of color in the city, 16, who endorsed, 14 did, all went with him, the three candidates. But the guy who made the biggest difference in this race, nobody ever covered, because it was the day that Barack Obama came to Boston. We were doing very well in the black and Hispanic and communities of color, but we still were having problem with people who are 55 plus, good voters, good black voters, in part because when you looked at two white guys and you didn't know either one of them, one came from West Roxbury, one came from Dorchester, and they were both Irish, the perception was is the guy from West Roxbury had to be the more liberal of the two guys. And there was a lot of confusion as to why these other candidates hadn't done it. When Mel King endorsed us, and there's a name that some of your listeners don't even remember.
Ran for mayor against Ray Flynn.
He is like John Lewis is in Atlanta. When you look at when he did that, that's the moment that we really knew that. And he did it. And I said to him later, and I'd known him from years and years ago. I was shocked that he remembered me, quite frankly. I was a pretty small fish. And he said to me, Marty Walsh worked with me 4 years ago on a project. I didn't even know that. Marty never told me. And so he said, I'm doing this because Marty Walsh was there when he wasn't running for mayor. And you know, it's amazing. This story is an epic story. I'm going to be long dead. And they're going to be talking about this race because it really was one of those classic upsets that, you know, when we say politics is always the same, not this year, not in Boston.
Okay, before you go, Michael Goldman, very quickly, he's been in Turks and Caicos, he admitted to us now, for 4 or 5, 6 days. Has he spoken to anybody in the campaign or is he actually taking time off?
He's done well.
Meaning, let me put it the other way. Meaning it's not nonstop.
It is not. It is.
Good.
He has been very good. He needed the rest. You know, he and Lori needed to get away. It's a terrific thing. But
he has checked in.
You know, again, it's hard to say. It's hard to say.
You know something?
If he hadn't, I would have been shocked. I mean, you know, there are moments, and there are a couple of things we had to run by him. But when he comes back, I think you're going to see a lot of the things that the press has been very focused on, the transition, big picture, what are your first big items, all that stuff will come into play. And
I think you can think well underneath those palm trees on the beach with that white sand.
Hey, I bought a Speedo,
you know?
And I was ready to go, and I was left at the plane thing while they were taking off. I'm embittered.
Michael Goldman and the Speedo. Michael, congratulations to you and the whole campaign. Good
thank
to
you.
See
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thank you
a
for
lot
coming
of people,
in.
And Marty Walsh in particular, again, it's, consultants get too much credit, too much blame. It's the candidate that makes a difference.
I agree with you.
Okay, Michael.
Take care, Michael.
Thank you for coming in. Michael is, of course, a political consultant and a key advisor to Mayor-elect Martin Walsh. When we come back, we're going to find out the secret behind Black Thursday. Are all those turkeys dying in vain? Will people forgo this holiday and get a jump start on Christmas shopping? People are starting to shop earlier and earlier and earlier every Thanksgiving season. We're going to find out if you're one of them. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's the Black Friday creep. You can't call it anything else. Macy's and then Best Buy, and as of yesterday, Walmart is part of it too. They're all open on Thanksgiving. And the question is quite simple. Are you going to be among the shopping masses on Thanksgiving Day itself? Are you keeping Thanksgiving, or as we have it this year, Thanksgivica, sacred? 877-301-8970. Let me put a few facts on the table, if
put
I can.
Put a few facts on the table, Jim.
So Black Friday, I think we would agree, was bad enough. There is now Black Thursday. That's number one. Number two, these chains are all planning on opening, I think, roughly at 6 o'clock. That's bad enough, 6 p.m. However, listen to the Best Buy situation, Marjorie. Best Buy will be handing out tickets to those who are in line at 4 o'clock for the doorbusters. You know, those are the real great deals. You're going to tell a story about one of the doorbusters in a couple of seconds. So that means if you want to go to Best Buy, you can't get there at 6. You can't even get there at 4. You have to be near the front of the line at 4, which means you have to be there at 3. That makes it worse. Now, the only
I think you have to get there.
At dawn, probably.
Exactly.
Okay, the only place where there's good news, and some may consider this to be bad news. By the way, our number is 877-301-8970. And by the way, tell the truth. If you're an addict, if you're a shopping addict, and you're just thrilled that you can down that stuffing at dawn so you can be at the stores by 10 a.m., let us know. The good or bad news, depending on your point of view, Massachusetts still has blue laws. And unless they're waived, which they are not, so I think since the early 2000s, not only, this is fascinating, not only can stores not open until midnight, Marjorie, they really can't open at midnight either. Do you know why? Because workers cannot, are not allowed to report to work until Thanksgiving is over. So if they can't report to work in Massachusetts till midnight, realistically speaking, they can't open the stores right away, 12:30, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, whatever it is. So there's a bit of a respite in Massachusetts. We want to know if you are a collaborator in what I consider to be this abomination. And it's just, Black Friday is horrible enough, and there are horrible stories. The Black Thursday thing is insane. Are you going to participate? Are you going to shop on Thursday? And why don't you share a cautionary tale with people?
Well, I will tell share a cautionary tale. It's one of my favorite tales of all time. The famous Patricia Van Lester Caper.
Mm-hmm.
She went into a Walmart several years ago. They had a great sale for Black Friday, $27.87 DVD players. She goes into Walmart, and she is trampled, as her sister said, by this herd of elephants chasing down after this $27 DVD. They were like vultures, her sister said. She suffered a seizure. She was other injuries, trampled like she was an animal.
And by the way, this is a national story. This was on
cautionary
every newscast
tale
around the country. The abomination of how this woman was abused
by
her fellow
this
shoppers.
This was a terrible tale of abuse against a shopper.
Horrible.
Except, as it turned out, as this Walmart spokesperson said, we are going to investigate this claim by Patricia Van Lester as thoroughly as we have investigated the 10 other claims this woman and her sister had brought against us in the past. In other words, she was scamming.
She was a serial trampoline, I guess.
That's right. She also apparently slipped on a puddle of hand lotion once at a Walgreens pharmacy and sued there, too. But you know something? Before we take the calls at 877-301-8970, we've discussed this before, Jim. It's become, for some people, a family tradition. It's as much as the turkey with all the fixins, one of my favorite Thanksgiving expressions.
I love that expression,
that people
too.
Have their dinner, go to the football game or watch the football games on television, and then they go and get in line for their annual shopping. And they've got everything charted out, and they've got, you know, their sister-in-law over at the widescreen TV things, and they've got the brother-in-law down.
By the way, for you non-participants, this is true. This is what people have told us through the years.
It becomes like their own football game afterwards with everybody in a certain place, and they get all their Christmas shopping done, and they're home, and they can relax for the rest of the Christmas season.
Now, in defense of these people, and there's no defense for these people, but in marginal defense of these people, they're most of them, particularly the men who participate, are in mourning to a degree, because since we now have flat screen TVs that mount on the walls, you can't take the television from the living room and put it right on the dining room table so you can watch the Thanksgiving football games during
the
meal. And so since you can't do that, they feel deprived. I have to say, I am not a huge traditionalist, meaning I am sort of, I think things do change. But I have to say, the fact that people can't take one day out of the whole year, and maybe Christmas too, can't take one or two days out of the whole year where they abstain from shopping. By the way, not forever, but, and by the way, you can go online. If you can't control yourself, then go to your computer. The fact that you leave your house with a war plan, and they really do, as you say.
They have a war plan.
So that
is correct.
How you can save $9 on a cell phone or something,
Here's
incredible.
Here's my prediction. That pretty soon we will do away with the turkey and all the fixins, and it will just be the war plan and shopping with the family on Thanksgiving. Not alone, but you have to have, like I said, the brother-in-laws, the cousins, the nieces and nephews. You have to have people standing in line. People, we've talked about this before, too. People pay.
Placeholders.
Yeah. People down on their luck, as we say, to hold their place in front of the Walmart or the Best Buy for hours.
Well, it's
hours.
Not just down on their luck. College kids do this to make money. You know, one compromise, because we're trying to be reasonable here before we get to the calls, you can just prepare a large Tupperware container for all members of your family with little cranberry sauce, a little stuffing, a little squash,
Jim,
a little turkey, maybe a ham.
It's the fixins.
It's the really, there are very few things about American culture that just totally put me over the edge, where I have no ability to see the other side of the issue.
Uh-huh.
And this is it. 877-301-8970. We are done ranting. This is an issue on which Marjorie and I walk lockstep. So here's your opportunity.
Let's go to Vincent from Fall River. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
What do you think?
So I'm a young 20-something, so I've been doing retail and my fair share of Black Fridays for probably about 7 years now.
Uh-huh.
I got to say, it's not going away anytime soon. It's basically, like, you can imagine how Super Bowl is a holiday in America, and I'm glad that Marjorie said it. Black Friday is basically another shopper's holiday.
That's right.
It's not really anything to say that, oh, we're going in the wrong direction. This is how the holiday works. You make a list, you go out, and it's almost a community, actually. The store that I work at, we had giveaways out in the front. There were small events for the children. I don't know why people bring children to their shopping event. But it's the community of it. It's actually a lot of fun if you give it a try.
Vincent, would you feel the same way I know you're in Fall River. If you were 20 miles to your south and you were in Rhode Island, which I believe is allowed to open on Thanksgiving, unlike
Massachusetts.
Would you still feel the same way if you had to get to work at 4 o'clock on Thanksgiving Day and the doors opened at 6 p.m.?
Call me lucky or unlucky. I'm not sure which, but because of my, I don't know if you want to say stature at where I work, I was one of the ones who'd be there for probably 15 to 18 hours. So getting there at Thanksgiving just to tell everyone that I've been there since probably 4 o'clock that day is just part of the experience.
Yeah,
Vincent, you're a good caller.
One last question to you, Vincent. Have you ever felt your life was in danger because, you know, we have had these tragedies?
Well, we shouldn't make a joke. People have died.
The clerk in one of these stores, the
security guard was killed a couple of years
ago. I'm sorry, it was the security guard. He was killed. That's right. When the throngs came through the door so fast that he was killed. I mean, have you ever felt in fear of your life?
Well, yeah, I have gotten sick multiple times. That's never prevented me from coming in, but I gotta say that we have plenty of pizza, pasta. We have catering, actually.
Oh, good.
How much would you like this guy to work for you? You're like the best employee, Vincent, who's probably ever called the show.
You want to tell us where you work?
That was actually Toys R Us.
There you go.
Toys R Us.
Hey, Vincent, thanks for the call. And by the way, Toys R Us, we left off the list. I think Toys R Us has announced that they're doing a 5 p.m. We mentioned Macy's, Walmart, and a couple others, Best Buy. I think those are 6 p.m.s on Thanksgiving. I believe that Toys R Us, their national plan, except in states like Massachusetts, is 5 p.m. It just I said it. 877-301-8970.
Okay, you don't have to do it. You don't.
And by the way,
have
you know,
go.
People should know who don't know me. Marjorie, I love shopping.
You love shopping.
I love the physical part of shopping. Meaning,
right.
I love walking down aisles. I love browse shopping, that sort of thing. It's just there's certain times and you shouldn't be doing it. Let's go to Clark and Beverly. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks for the call, Clark.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. First of all, I just want to say I love the show. I listen to it every day at lunch.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wanted to just make a couple points, actually. One is to really look down on the folks who, you know, run and trample over everybody. That's simply awful. But I will say I am a pretty big fan of Black Friday, and I'll just give you a quick example, and I'll let you guys take it from there. But last Black Friday, I was able to get a 60-inch TV for $550. I don't know if you guys have looked at 60-inch TVs lately, but, you know, usually they're around the $1,500 to
$2,000.
Wow. So you saved $1,000.
Wow.
Great deal.
Now, Clark, here's the true test of you. If there was one of those $550 60-inch TVs left and you were saving $950 and between you was a 79-year-old lady and that television, who would get the television?
I'd say I'd have to make a run for it, but, you know, if she made it there first, God bless her, I'd definitely let her have it. But,
that's actually a healthy behavior. Clark, thank you for your honesty, and thank you for listening, and thanks for your call.
You know, here's one of the great things. Okay, Clark got his TV at a great discount, and lots of people,
that
like
is a
I
lot
said,
of money.
They get 90% of their shopping done. I mean, how many of us are in a panic running around and, you know, Christmas Eve or the 23rd of December furious, can't get to any Christmas parties because you're so behind in your shopping? I mean, these people are organized. They're efficient.
You ever done this? Not Black Friday. Well, have you ever done this kind of thing on a huge shopping day? I have.
No.
One of the most stressful things, the only thing more stressful than being in the store is being in line outside the store when you know from the ad there are 100 X's, whatever the X thing is you want, and it doesn't limit the number per person. I mean, every part of this, from planning it, from having to rush through the meal.
I know.
There are very few moments when you have, on Thanksgiving, that's nothing. You don't call anybody. You're not in a rush. You know who used to call, and one of the sweetest men who ever lived? I've told you this story. Paul Sullivan, our great, great friend who died far too soon.
Columnist.
And great nighttime talk show host on WBZ. My phone would ring on Thanksgiving. I'll never forget this. And I'd look at it, and Paul's name, I'd say, what? I mean, we were friendly. We're not best friends. We were pretty friendly. And Paul, you pick up the phone. This almost makes me cry. And Paul, I say, Paul, how are you? Thanks so much for what's going on. He said, well, it's Thanksgiving. I just wanted to thank you for being my friend. And I go, oh, my, you know, real. It just, and by the way, I assume if I was in line at Best Buy at that time, I might not have gotten the call. The point is, there are very few intrusions except wonderful moments like that. You're doing the family and friend thing. You're relaxing. You're shutting down. And I hear what the caller said a minute ago. Saving $950 on a TV is very appealing to me, like hugely appealing to me. No one loves a bargain more than I do. But there's a line that you just, I don't know.
But as I say, you relax and you have a nice time with your family and you watch the games and then you go out and do. In Massachusetts, you can't do it till 12:30 in the morning.
At least 12:30.
That's right.
At least 12. Isn't that? Did you know about the labor laws?
No,
I mean, I knew the stores couldn't open because of Blue Friday.
I hope people get time and a half. Well, that's the other thing. Who really wants to work on Thanksgiving? That's the problem.
Well, but, what was his name? Vincent.
He wants to work on Thanksgiving. Lots of people have to work on Thanksgiving, though, unfortunately. And let's hope they get time and a half. Bill in Milford, what do you think about Black Friday and shopping on Thanksgiving, Bill?
I think it's okay in a small amount. It's always been sort of something I've done a little bit on Black Friday.
What do you mean? No more than like 9 or 10 hours? Is that what you mean, Bill?
No, not at all.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, right. Starting in college, really, the Thanksgiving thing's always been about family and friends. I mean, it's one of the few holidays that most of my employers have always said, you know, Friday's off. You have this chunk of time. You see your friends, you come in back from college, you see all your friends and your family. We have a pretty big family. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is just blow it all off shopping. And I frankly think the whole savings thing is basically sort of to make you want to come. The fact is you can save that $900 all sorts of ways. You don't have to do it on that particular day. It's kind of like, do you run with the crowd or do you find the other path? It's like the Walt Whitman moment. Or
so why do you do it? When you say you do it in limited doses on Friday, why do you do it
In other words, limited doses meaning we'll go up to the hill for, and just do a little shopping for, you know, half an hour. Enjoy the holiday kind of spirit. The stores are open, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
This is back in the hometown, which, by the way, is the same as yours.
Oh, in Philly?
Yeah, Chestnut Hill.
Yeah, I hear a little bit of that accent. You live in Milford now?
Yeah, part of the time.
How are you voting on the casino?
Oh, totally no. I'm a total no voter on
that.
Okay.
Nice to hear from you, Bill. I'm smiling as you speak. Bill, thanks for the call. Fellow Philly boy. Are you able to detect the Philly accent underneath it? Yeah.
No.
You can hear it Philly to Philly.
We have a poem, Jim.
Poem?
From Barbara.
What is it?
It's called Thanksgiving.
Diane.
By snaking along in traffic jams from hell to be first at big box stores that sell big boxes of stuff that we don't need, we initiate the Thanksgiving season of greed.
That's actually quite beautiful. Did she write that or she
wrote that.
Posted it?
Barbara, that was beautiful.
That is quite beautiful.
W.H. Auden there.
Let's go to Barry, Massachusetts, and Kira's on the phone. Hey there, Kira.
Hi. My family and I used to do Black Friday most years until I remember one of the last times we went to rent them at the outlet. And, it was really crowded and everything, and half the stores were even open because I guess it's up to the stores individually, their discretion, whether they really want to go through all that or
true.
Not.
Yes, that's true, of course, yeah.
And then one of the employees that we spoke with at one of the stores even said they didn't know why everybody even came out that night because basically all the stores had been running the same sales all week. It was just the hype of that night that actually really got, everybody out then. So that was kind of the last Black Friday we ever did. It just didn't seem worth it anymore.
That's a great point. It is part of the thing. One of these callers said it. It's to be part of a thing. It's a cultural thing.
Exactly.
To be out there doing it. Kira, you're a healthy woman. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Tom has a different perspective, Jim.
What does he say?
He says he would love to work on Thanksgiving Day. Then he would not have to face family members and eat dinner with them all.
Well, you don't think that's part of the motivation of a lot of people? Of course it is.
I do. I mean, being a newspaper reporter when I was young, you got stuck a lot working on Thanksgiving. It was kind of nice. They brought in the turkey and all the fixins. And I mean, what's the point without the fixins?
Yeah.
But a lot of the reporters were saying that. They didn't particularly want to go to their mother-in-law's. They didn't want to go home to their family or blah, blah, blah. So they weren't that upset about it. Let's go to Jim from Barry. What do you think about Black Friday and shopping on Thanksgiving, Jim?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Hi there, Jim.
Hey,
Jim, we got to put you on hold for a minute. It's a horrible connection. Don't go away. We'll put you on hold. We'll take a call, and I promise we'll get right back to you to hope this cell is better. Lisa, you're in Quincy. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
So I think shopping on Thanksgiving is horrible. It's a day for family. And my family gets along really well. We watch the football games, and we just drink a whole lot of wine.
Good for you.
And it's not like we get in a fight at the end. We're all very happy. So we couldn't make it out. There would be no designated driver.
So you mean you couldn't do it even if you wanted to do it, Lisa, correct?
No. And then I would end up buying a whole bunch of stupid things.
That you didn't want. Lisa, you are the perfect person. Loves the family. They all get together. They drink a lot. And they stay inside. They don't drive. It's perfect. Lisa, thanks for the call. Let's try Jim from Barry one more time. Jim, let's see if the cell's better. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Much better. Great.
Thank you. Hey, no, I'm not going to go shopping on Thanksgiving nor the day after. I support no shopping on Friday. It's a national movement started by Adbusters. You know, I think we're caught in this thing where I consume, therefore I am.
That's pretty good.
And, you know, I think we're much more than that, and it's in a certain way, it's eroding the fabric, this consumerism that we could have newer, bigger, and better every day, every year. And, you know, we're just consuming the planet up as fast as we can. And anyway, I'm going to go hiking with my wife and spend some time with my mother-in-law and enjoy the time off. I've worked in retail previously, and, I think you can get good deals on things other times, and a lot of the stuff you get on those sales is it'll be in the trash heap next year.
Well, it's also what Kira said. She makes a very good point. Is you should do some. Most of us are good comparative shoppers. Don't compare just seller to seller. Compare day to day, and you're probably getting no great, much better bargain than you'd get it a couple of days earlier, a couple of days later. Jim, thanks for the call. Enjoy the hike.
But it is true about getting the things, and every year getting things for people who don't need anything, and you're trying to rack your brain about what they need. Remember the guy we had in here about happiness, and he talked about
the guy from Harvard.
You're much better off.
What's his name?
Experiences.
Michael Norton, who's fabulous.
Yes, experiences. You know, so you could. I suppose you could buy theater tickets or something like that.
Right. Money doesn't buy you. Money and things don't necessarily buy you happiness.
Yeah.
I guess,
well, you know, some of those ridiculous
things.
I mean, think of. I mean, the $19 foot massager I got a couple of years ago. What was that? I mean, I'm going to.
Can I tell you something? I have five of those. Because they were, and you figure you never know when one's going to break down, when you'll need one. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
By the way, it is. I want to be clear. This is hard for. I'm making it sound so simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me because I love shopping. I really love. I know you don't. I love shopping. And I don't like crowds, which I guess is a problem come these days. But it's a real allure. When you see the ad, it's a big deal. But you have to resist. What was that called? No shopping? What's the national movement that's
Adbusters.
Going on? Well, Adbusters is the organization.
I'll have to look that
up. But is
up.
It no shopping Friday?
No shopping Friday? On Friday because you're supposed to get the day off and enjoy it with your family. Lots of people do have that Friday off, which is great. Sean from Dedham. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Sean. What's going on?
Hey, guys. Hey, Marjorie. Thanks for being a friend.
You're welcome, Sean. Anything
Thank
I can
you.
Do.
What did I do, Sean?
I'm not talking to you, Jimmy.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Take it away.
Here's the deal. These people that go out are losers. You know when Laverne Shirley had that big L on her sweater? They should have to wear an L on their sweater, on their jacket, or their shirt. And say, I'm a loser. Like, let everyone know it. I'm a loser. Come on, people. Do you ever talk to your kids? Maybe spend time with your mother? You know, maybe talk to your neighbor, have a few beers, and say hi? Come on, people. There's no need to go out and buy this crap.
Okay, sure.
Sean, it was beautifully put by you, I should
I hope
say.
You
Thank
have
you
a lovely Thanksgiving with all the fixins. There you go. Let's go to Herb in East Boston.
Hey, Herb.
Hi, Herb.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
Good.
I wanted to say that I do not shop on Black Friday, and I definitely won't be shopping on Thanksgiving holiday. I'd take the holiday for what it is, to be thankful for my family and my friends and my country and community. And it's doing a disservice because some of these people that work for these big box retailers are forced to work. You know, it's kind of a mandatory thing. It's either you work or you can be fired.
Which is awful. And
that's a great point, yeah, Herb. That's a very important point. Yep.
Yeah, it's horrible treatment of, you know, of your workers, and it shows how much you really value them and their time. I mean, we have, you know, the whole year to shop. You know, we can do it before the Thanksgiving holiday. We can do it after the Thanksgiving holiday. Let's keep something sacred and be grateful for something in our lives.
Herb, you should be the spokesperson for whatever that thing is. No Friday or whatever. You were great. Herb, let's take one more quick one. We're going to Wakefield, Rhode Island for this one.
How grateful was the guy about his $500 television?
$550. I would be hard for me to resist. Plus, he said, to his credit, he would not trample the old lady. To get ahead of her,
he would not. Well, that's what he said anyway.
Heather, we're going to wrap it up with you. You're calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Hi there, Heather.
Hi. How are you guys?
We're excellent. Thank you for the call.
That's great. I'm calling because I've spent most of my life working in the hospitality industry.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I have friends that work in the medical industry, and we all work holidays.
Which is awful.
So I'm just calling to say that, you know, there are a bunch of industries in our country that work all holidays, and for some reason that goes by under the radar today.
Well, you know, it's a much smaller industry that works on holidays, by the way. Ours.
Yeah.
The beauty of the news business is the longer you're there, the less likely it is that
Thank
you have
God.
To work Thanksgiving and Christmas. But we don't shut down either.
And, yeah, the media.
But you guys have many
and
more people doing it. Yeah.
Obviously, and hotels. You're right, Heather. All those places have to work all the time.
And I would think airlines.
Airlines. Yeah. Trains.
The list goes on and on. So I just wanted those people that work holidays to get recognition for the fact that they always work holidays.
Heather, we're glad you gave them that recognition. Thank you very much for the call. Trust me, by the way, we will return to this topic in the days ahead as we approach. What is it? The 29th is the Friday, and the 28th is Thanksgiving.
Right? I don't think I ever get tired of telling the story of Patricia Van Lester, who claims she was trampled at Walmart and trampled the next day at Walmart and the next week.
We should track that woman down.
Trampled 10 times at Walmart. I'm going to sneeze, Jim.
Oh, bless you, Marjorie. You want me to say what's coming up,
okay,
or do you want to do
I'm
it?
Ready.
Okay, go ahead.
When we get back, we're going to look at another way you can spend your money, casinos. Ooh. Sorry,
whoa,
sneezing. Could a resort-style gaming mecca wind up on Martha's Vineyard? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So will the famous store, The Black Dog on Martha's Vineyard, have to start carrying poker chips and playing cards? Will the Island Bar and Grill start serving cocktails with names like Black Russian Roulette and Casino Creme Royale? It could happen. As I'm sure you know, yesterday the Wampanoag Tribe of Aquinna announced it has won federal approval, which will allow it to open a casino on its tribal land on Martha's Vineyard. Join us to go over what this means and whether it'll ever happen as Paul Provino. Paul is the editor-in-chief of the Cape Cod Times. Hey there, Paul.
Good morning, folks.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining us. So the tribe, of course, does have land on Martha's Vineyard, the Gayhead section, but I was kind of surprised by this. Was this expected or was this a surprise to you guys on the Cape and to the people of Martha's Vineyard?
Yeah, I think this was a surprise to everybody except the Aquinna Wampanoag.
Okay.
They've been saying from the beginning that they had rights to have gaming facilities, that they are federally recognized Indian nation, and therefore, just like the Mashpee Wampanoag, which of course have had a lot of headlines over the past year plus, they felt that they too should be in the running here, and they made some efforts to negotiate with the Commonwealth, and Governor Patrick said that his administration believed that they didn't have the same standing as the Mashpee Wampanoag for a number of reasons, and therefore they never really talked except at the most preliminary of levels. And but meanwhile, the Aquinnah tribe had been pursuing their own options, and they secured just a couple weeks ago a very important opinion from the National Indian Gaming Commission that basically says they have the right to open a gaming facility at least on tribal land on Martha's Vineyard, and possibly even off island as well. So pretty fascinating.
Of course, it's a little we're talking about a gambling casino, a hall, basically slots in an unfinished community center. They're not talking about like what we're talking about up here in Everett with this massive, you know, Steve Wynn resort.
Well, wait a second. That's what they're saying. I mean, the reality is, I am assuming they say they don't want to have a Wynn resort because the people on Martha's Vineyard would
that's
have a stroke.
That's what I want to ask Paul. I mean, is that legit that they're talking about a small bingo slots type place?
Well, I think it is in the sense that right now that's essentially all they qualify for. But bear in mind that, you know, the word bingo is sort of a loaded term. I mean, we think of, you know, church basement bingo.
Right.
But in fact, obviously, these bingo slots are basically slot machines. And tribes in Florida made billions off of the slots before the state finally capitulated and said, you know what, we're gonna negotiate with you since we're missing out on all sorts of revenue and we're gonna work out a deal. So this certainly is a wedge for the Aquinnah Wampanoag to get the state to try to negotiate. And while it sounds like they can do something right away in sort of the bingo slots realm, right on the island, right in their community center, I think that they probably are looking to do something bigger, more along the lines of a resort casino off island. It probably is not sustainable on Martha's Vineyard, but certainly in the southeastern region of Massachusetts, which they've looked at for years, well before gambling was even legal in Massachusetts. The Aquinnah Wampanoag were talking about a casino in the Fall River area, and it never came to fruition. But, you know, I don't think they ever really dropped those plans.
Well, you know, actually, it sounds like you're pursuing a line here that we can pursue with the governor when he's with us tomorrow. Are you suggesting here that what they're doing is they want to use, not your word, the threat of doing something on Martha's Vineyard to get the governor and potentially the Gaming Commission to give them something in southeastern Massachusetts that they might not otherwise be crazy about giving them?
Yeah, well, they've always wanted more attention than they've received, and it's been frustrating for the tribe that they have not had an opportunity to negotiate a compact, as have the Mashpee Wampanoag. In fact, as we know, the Mashpee Wampanoag negotiated a compact, brought it to the federal government. The federal government turned it down, saying that it was too lucrative for the Bay State and not enough for the tribe. And so they went back to the drawing board, and just this week, the House and Senate have approved a new compact. So the Mashpee Wampanoag have had sort of the inside track when it comes to Indian gaming. The Aquinnah have wanted the same. And so they do want to have a place at the bargaining table. Of course, you know, it will create a lot of confusion and chaos on Beacon Hill as a result, because this has not been the cleanest process to begin with. This is only going to further complicate
things. Yeah, the Globe has a story this morning saying that essentially the islanders are mixed on this thing. As a casual observer of this, my sense is if you polled the people on Martha's Vineyard and said, do you want this casino, even if it's of modest scale, in our midst, my guess is that the overwhelming percentage of people down there would say absolutely not. What's your take on that, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to get a read on people. I think, like the Globe, the what we've received is a mixed opinion from folks, and frankly, a lot of folks kind of surprised and wanting to digest the news and understand fully what's going on here.
Well, wait a second. Wait a second. When you say mixed, very quickly, other than small businesses who see more customers coming in and young people who, as they say in the Globe, have something to do at night, who wants this?
This is an islanders versus the beautiful people kind of thing, I would think. The whole island is a totally different spot in summer. Half that stuff is closed now, right, Paul? I mean, we're talking about the zillionaires arriving in July and August. I can't imagine they'd be thrilled with even a small casino, but the islanders may want one for business.
Well, obviously, this time of the year is very quiet, as you point out. Now through March is, this island, any seasonal economy is driven by those few months. And basically those businesses, reap the rewards of the summer and then hang on through the winter. And so maybe this will help extend it. But on the other hand, anything that is going to drive up people and traffic on the already very, very congested island of Martha's Vineyard is a challenge even for the year-round businesses. I mean, you just look at the time around when the president has been visiting over the past few years in August. It has become a nightmare there.
It's a mess.
And so, you know, take that and magnify the bus trips that you would have there and what have you. I mean, it would be an issue, definitely.
We're talking with Paul Provenot, the editor-in-chief of the Cape Cod Times. I just want to be clear on one thing, though. But what you're talking about, the possible suggestion of the tribe is either we have a small bingo slots deal on the island, and then we have a big deal thing in Fall River, you know, or maybe someplace else. But you're not talking about a big resort-style casino on Martha's Vineyard.
Well, I mean, frankly, it's not the whole picture is not completely clear at this point. And really, that's a question for the tribe. But what they've postulated is the idea of the bingo slots in the community hall that they've been renovating. So that's something they feel like they could do almost right away.
Yep.
What happens from there remains to be seen. But certainly, you know, when we talk to folks on Beacon Hill, everyone from folks in the governor's office to the Senate president's office and down the line, they said, wow, is this April 1st? You know, we need to figure out what's happening here, because this is obviously going to change the discussion.
Well, yeah, and it's been very clear, made clear in your paper, The Globe and elsewhere, that the governor is not happy with this, has no intention of this going forward. His council is speaking to everybody. I want to get back to this bingo slot thing. I think it was George Brennan who wrote the piece talking about the Florida, the billions they made in Florida in your paper.
Right.
Was it your thing?
Yeah.
It's really important for people to say, oh, well, it's bingo. Bingo slot is almost a misnomer, because as you say a minute ago, most of us think it's little old ladies, you know, with those little cards screaming at each other and elbowing each other out of the way, like in whatever that's.
It's little old ladies in front of machines.
But essentially, they're de facto slot machines, aren't they?
That's exactly what they are.
Right.
They're de facto slot machines.
So the we should almost take the word bingo out of the mix, because it's it gives us
a slot parlor.
A slot parlor, and some of us have visited those. You know, the interesting thing for me, Paul, is that there are people like Charlie Baker, when he was running for governor, who said, let's do one and see how it goes before we decide on three. But because of the rights that Indian tribes have, we potentially could end up with, in fact, we asked this question of the Gaming Commission this morning, and their response was it was too hypothetical at this early stage. We can end up not with three casinos, but with five casinos and a slots parlor, the three commercial ones, the Mashpee tribe on the mainland, the Wampanoags of Aquinnah. We could have five casinos and a slots parlor in Massachusetts at the end of this thing, right?
Absolutely. And that has always been the risk of how Massachusetts structured gaming when they legalized it. The tribes had always asserted their rights to say, look, whatever you do, we're going to have our own opportunities for gaming. So make sure that we're part of the picture. And that's what was helpful to the Mashpee Wampanoag, to sort of get the southeastern portion of the state carved out for themselves in the inside track. Now, of course, this changes the ballgame, because, you know, now the Aquinnah come forward and are negotiating. There has been motions among lawmakers, particularly from southeastern Massachusetts, the New Bedford Fall River area, to say, wait a minute, we're tired of waiting for the Mashpee Wampanoag to get their act together with federal approvals and whatnot. So let's give a commercial casino down there. But once the Mashpee and the Aquinnah, now it seems, get rolling, you're right. It could be up to five.
Hey, before we let you go, we're going to talk, when we hang up on you, Paul, we're going to talk to our listeners about NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Do you mind my asking where you live, or is that a closely guarded secret?
No, I live on the Cape. I live in the village of Kituit, which is a very small place.
Do you want a casino or a slot parlor in Kituit?
If they could figure out a place to put it in, no, I mean,
listen, I'm laughing.
I mean, the truth is, obviously there will be a NIMBY factor, and always is a NIMBY factor,
sure,
wherever casinos are located. But for some folks, they believe that the economic impact outweighs those concerns. I think that's why you see a lot of gateway cities, you know, basically fighting it out, trying to get the casinos to come. You know, there was, you know, New Bedford and
Everett, 87% in Everett voted in favor of the Wynn proposal recently.
Right. So exactly. And so here with Martha's Vineyard, I think it's going to be an interesting dynamic as this plays out, as it would be on the Cape. Now, it's interesting. The Mashpee Wampanoag had said from the very beginning, yes, we have lands in Mashpee. Yes, you know, we're here on Cape Cod, but we're not going to build a casino there, because they knew that A, the traffic couldn't sustain it, and yeah. B, they knew the people wouldn't support it.
We can just imagine. We can just imagine, Paul, if last 4th of July, it took me 3 hours to get to the bridge from center 15 miles. Boy, with a casino, I can only imagine. It could be 7 or 8 hours.
Back to Provincetown. Hey, last thing, Paul, just for clarification, when you talk about the people approving, the major difference. Well, one of the major differences between these Native American tribes casinos and commercial non-Native American casinos is in the latter situation, like we just saw in East Boston or in Everett or wherever, the people have to vote yes for it to happen. Technically, the people of Martha's Vineyard don't get a vote here. I mean, ultimately, there may be political pressure that causes them to decide to go elsewhere, or the governor may prevail legally. But technically, the people of Martha's Vineyard don't have a vote, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there are nuances along the way where different communities get some say when it comes to Native American casinos. But overall, if you have Native lands, sovereign lands, you're allowed to do it. And that's why this opinion that the Aquinnah Wampanoag got from the National Gaming Commission is so important, because they said, you know what, you can do it on your land. So it was a very eyebrow-raising event.
Paul Provino, thanks so much for your time. That was great.
Thanks, folks.
Good luck down there in Kituit, Paul.
Thanks. We can almost see it from Kituit.
Exactly. Paul Provino is the editor-in-chief of the Cape Cod Times.
Okay, so now it's up to you all at 877-301-8970. There are a multitude of questions. One, does anyone believe there will ever be a casino on Martha's Vineyard? And the answer is, at least in my estimation, forget about it. That's number one. Number two, this is all about NIMBYism everywhere, is it not? It's not in my backyard.
Exactly.
If you're okay having it in your community, like the Arne Everett, fine. But it's not about what's good for the state or bad for the state. It's not about any of those issues. It's about, do I want one near me? And the third question, which I know we're going to focus, the governor will be with us from noon to one tomorrow in studio, and hope you'll call, and we have some questions too. What I said is factually accurate, even though when Will, our colleague, called the Gaming Commission, they said it's too hypothetical. We could end up with 5 casinos and a slots parlor, 2 Indian Native American casinos, 3 commercially licensed casinos, and a slots parlor. I mean, remember Shelley Adelson, who was the guy who is from Dorchester, who's now a billionaire, said we only had the business potential to do one. We can end up with 5.5 if you consider a slot parlor a half. So you can address any of those issues that move you. 877-301-8970. Let me ask you, as an occasional islander, obviously you spend time on the Cape with your sister down there.
Right.
What are the odds, you think, that the people of Martha's Vineyard are going to allow a casino, even a modest one, as described in the paper this morning, to ever open its doors?
You know who Summers on Martha's Vineyard?
The President of the United States.
Well, who's there pretty much a lot more than that?
Who's that?
Alan Dershowitz.
He won't allow. We should ask
Alan
Dershowitz what he thinks.
To the rescue. Somehow I can't see it. You know, with the beautiful people that are down there in the summertime, you've got the historic, you know, black community, the Henry Louis Gates from Harvard, and all the distinguished black professors who are down there at one end of the island. You've got, you know, the Jackie O estate. I mean, she's no longer with us, obviously, but she's there. You know, you get the whale pants set. I just can't see the mix of the whale pants set, you know, with the weddings that they're going to have and the beautiful sunset with the crowd at the slots.
I don't think so.
I just don't, the little old ladies at their slot machines with their dollar, you know, their dollar coins going to that machine. It just doesn't seem. But, you know, do you hear what Paul said? Technically, there may not be a vote. You know,
there's not. There's a zoning issue potentially. And then Deval Patrick will explain it to us more clearly tomorrow. The state believes, Deval Patrick and his lawyer, his chief counsel, believe that they do not have a right to build this. But the apparently objective people quoted in the Globe this morning, who are casino experts, suggested that. Let's start in Worcester. Dan, you're on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Maggie and Jim.
Hey there.
Hey, listen, I think it'd be a fantastic idea to have that on Martha's Vineyard.
I knew you would.
Picture this. You know, you got busloads of gamblers coming to the island now from some very scenario. They get there. Now, they're all half in the bag. They're all going to take a leak. They jump off the bus. They're peeing on Carly Simon's front lawn, throwing cigarettes everywhere. Does it get any more perfect than that? I hope that somehow in God's green earth, that the engines get it up on DeVal Patrick and put a destination gambling joint over there.
Dan, how did I know that this would make you happy? Thank you for your painting, your picture of what could happen there. On the,
that's right. I forgot about Carly Simon. Is the Hot Tin Roof or Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, whatever her place is down there, still operating? I don't know. Let's go to Peyton from Somerville. What do you think about a sloth parlor on the vineyard?
You know, I think I actually don't think it would be that bad of an idea. I don't see it actually happening, but who knows? This time of the year, you get a bus trip when there's nothing going on the island anyways, a bunch of old people or people from Chinatown take a bus down to the Cape and then the ferry over. And gamble for the day and spend some money. You know, could be some jobs for year-round residents and kind of in the off-season.
By the way, some people in this Globe story this morning, it says the community is split. As I said a couple of minutes ago to Paul, it's small business owners who think, obviously, it's going to pump up their business. The question is it going to pump up their business or destroy their business? But it's also a lot of young workers who work at bars and restaurants and things like that, as you're suggesting, Peyton. You're saying, bring it on, because it means more customers and more hours work for us. So I guess there are two sides, even though I would bet if a poll were done tomorrow, we were talking about David Paleologus from Suffolk a little while ago. If David did a poll, my guess is the bulk of those able to vote on the vineyard would probably do a big fat no. Let's squeeze one more
in. You know what? Can you vote on the vineyard if you're a summer resident? I'm not sure
No.
So it would be the Islanders that would be doing the bulk of the
wherever your principal
voting.
Residence is.
Yeah.
If you register as your principal residence where you spend the summer, I guess legally you can. Sheila, you're in Norton. Quickly, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Sheila.
Oh, I love the Globe article with the guy saying everyone else just doesn't have the vibe.
Yeah.
From Martha's Vineyard. I love that. But I'm wondering two things. You know, it would be so much better in than Martha's Vineyard to have it in Fall River or New Bedford. Who wants to take a ferry, pay the ferry to go over to gamble to then lose more money? And also, I would think, wouldn't there be zoning for, is it when it's a sovereign area for the Indians, is there still zoning that has to go through?
Well, I believe from the stories I read this morning, I have quite a few. There is a zoning issue, at least according to some officials, but I cannot tell a lie, Sheila. I don't understand it well enough to describe it. But those who are unhappy with it, whether it's Deval Patrick in terms of the compact in general or some zoning types, say there are still some legal avenues. But again, the Native American, the tribe itself, and a lot of the experts who are impartial just disagree. Hey, Sheila, thanks for the call. We are going to take one more really quick one because the caller is from Martha's Vineyard. David, quickly, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Which side are you on, David?
I run a nonprofit in Chilmark, and it's a pretty bleak and unpopulated area 10 months of the year. So, I mean, there are certainly people who live there, but there are very few business development opportunities. And one thing we have to say about the tribe is that I think the tribe, you know, like a lot of things here on the vineyard in the off season, is all about economic struggle and class and whatever. So this is a tried and true business development thing for tribal nations across the country.
So if there were a vote, you'd be a yes vote, David.
I'm not sure if I would vote for it or not. I mean, I deal with a lot of arts issues, and I want to just say I'm glad to be on here. I think I'm the one person on the figure who listens to you guys.
Oh, actually, there's a great photographer, Peter Simon, who lives in your neck of the woods, who's a regular too, David. So you are not alone, and I'm sure I hope there are many more. David, we got to go. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope there are a couple down there in the vineyard, Jim.
God, I really do hope so.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to continue our You Are Not Alone series with some counterintuitive news. Caregivers could actually be healthier than non-caregivers. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're continuing our series, You Are Not Alone, with a look at the health benefits that may come with caregiving. Joining us in Studio 3 is someone who's been doing a lot of research on this. Lisa Fredman is a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at Boston University's School of Public Health. She's now obviously a colleague of Tom Menino. Lisa Fredman, nice to have you in studio. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So thank you for being here. So before we get into this whole, what we mentioned before, the kind of counterintuitive research about health effects of caregiving, I just want to ask you, when we talk about caregivers, who are we talking about? Who are the typical caregivers? Children?
Caregivers can be anyone. And nationally, caregivers tend to be older women.
Yep.
But often they're the spouse. In my research, caregivers are anyone who helps a relative or often a friend with basic activities of daily living because that person can't do those independently.
Okay, and why do people do – what's the primary motivation? I know it's hard to generalize, but try as best you can. Is it because people feel an emotional connection to the person for whom they're giving care? Is it because of financial concerns? What gets people from their normal lives to this responsibility?
I think it's all of the above. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, you are faced with a situation where a relative or sometimes a neighbor or a friend or someone from church is having difficulty caring for themselves in the community. And so family members often just take it on. They don't even realize they're taking it on. First, they're helping, you know, their mother or their husband with balancing the checkbooks, doing basic activities, and then depending on whatever condition is sort of the reason why the person had difficulties with these, you just often end up taking on more and more.
Yeah, you just said something that I'd never thought about, and I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't, is people aren't trained to do this for the most part. It comes upon them often with very little notice.
Yes.
And often then helping people with tasks where they don't necessarily have some great expertise, particularly sharing that, even if they have it, sharing it with somebody else.
Absolutely.
So how do people get up to speed? Just trial and error? Is that what it is?
You know, that's funny. I think it's very difficult for people to get up to speed. When we do research, and we do a lot of research on people who start out as not caring for someone and become a caregiver, often it starts with a couple helping with a couple of these daily tasks, and it's enormously stressful. And you're floundering and you're dealing with the health professionals, and often you don't know where to turn and you don't know whom to ask advice
from. Well, not only that, and you have to talk about stress, which is the word you hear most commonly, at least
Absolutely.
We do anecdotally.
Yeah.
It's got to have your, you got to continue to do your own life,
yeah.
which is often stressful enough, in addition to helping direct someone else's at a pretty mm-hmm. critical juncture in their lives.
We're talking with Lisa Fredman from BU, who's done a lot of research on this subject. Lisa, why'd you get into this? I mean, I know you're at BU, you teach there and you're a researcher there, but why did you get into researching issues about elderly caregiving?
Yeah. So, well, I'm trained as an epidemiologist.
Yep.
So we do research on how often psychological factors affect health. And when I started designing my own studies, I had a couple of options. And I actually had grown up in a family where my mother had been a caregiver for my grandmother for many years. And my mother had died at a relatively young age of a heart attack. And my family and I were always sort of curious as to whether this might have been partly due to how stressful it was. She was one of those caregivers who didn't give up her job.
Yeah, and by the way, I would assume, and hopefully in most cases doesn't lead to death, before I read your work and the work of some of your colleagues, the conventional wisdom I totally bought into, that there is nothing but bad news for the individual caregiver in terms of their health or mortality rate, you come to a stunningly different conclusion.
Well,
what is it?
Hold on. Before we get to that conclusion, though, just tell me how old your mother was and what happened. She worked full-time and took care of your grandmother full-time?
Yeah,
how
which
old was your mother
not
when
easy.
She died?
She was 68.
68.
So
that is
to me now, young. That seems relatively young.
Yeah.
It was young, and it was a sudden heart attack.
And it was and you thought her situation was very stressful?
Yeah,
she
was not shy about saying how stressful it was.
Okay.
Okay, so tell us what you found that, at least in my world, is completely counterintuitive. What did you conclude?
Well, just to begin with, I started, in fact, the first two times that I applied for funding, my hypotheses were that caregivers were going to have poorer health outcomes than non-caregivers. So I was pretty shocked as well. But what we started seeing, and also let me say, can I describe a little bit about how we do our research?
Sure.
So we, I was concerned that a lot of the studies that I've read and that I'm sure you're familiar with didn't seem to have like a standard way of defining who was a caregiver and who wasn't a caregiver. Often a caregiver was someone who was like a spouse or a family member who accompanied the care recipient to medical appointments. But what I wanted to do from an epidemiologic perspective was to have a set of questions that I would give to all of the potential participants. And depending on their answers to that set of questions, we would classify them as either caregivers or non-caregivers. So people didn't come to us. My first study was part of a much larger study. And we basically asked all of the people in the study, who are all actually older women, whether they helped a relative or friend without pay with each of a series of activities of daily living, which is essentially how one defines an informal caregiver.
Right.
And those participants who said yes, they helped a relative or friend, we classified as caregivers. And those who said no, we classified as non-caregivers.
You know what this is like? It's like pollsters, registered voters and likely voters. You essentially
Absolutely.
Did. And so let's work backwards because we're relatively short on time. What did you find? What did you conclude?
And the other thing that I did do as well, because I noticed that most of the other studies didn't do this, was I had a standardized perceived stress scale called the perceived stress scale that we administered to absolutely everyone. So we had data that showed that our caregivers were much more stressed. They were significantly more stressed than our non-caregivers, mm-hmm. which is exactly what you would expect. But from the very beginning, we saw that the caregivers were actually healthier, that they walked faster. They ended up having lower rates of mortality. In some analyses we did, they actually had better cognitive performance. And so what did I do? I basically thought I coded the data the wrong way. And we checked and we rechecked. And it just kept coming out louder and clearer. And
but
so,
why?
So,
because
yeah,
they have a
why?
Sense of purpose, because they're more physically active, because
yeah.
they feel like they're valuable. What's the
yeah.
reason? What are the reasons?
So why? Well, I think there are two things. We also ask our caregivers what's rewarding, mm-hmm. and many of them do say that they have a purpose for living. They feel as they get enormous – some of them get enormous psychological gratification from this. But caregiving also keeps you active. I mean, you have to be active enough, you have to be healthy enough to become a caregiver. And for older women, if they aren't healthy enough to take care of, let's say, their husband or their sister, then their daughter or their daughter-in-law steps in. So fundamentally, it really looks as though people who are older, who become caregivers, who take on that role, are healthier from the get-go. And then as possibly as a function of performing these activities, you know, helping someone to walk, driving them to doctor's appointments, even being sort of cognitively alert enough to make the doctor's appointments, to calculate like when people should be taking their pills, it's one of these activities that might keep you healthy and functioning.
Now, I know you're a researcher. I mean, this is Lisa Fredman from the Boston BU School of Public Health, and maybe you don't want to make this leap that I'm about to make. So can we assume that if caregivers are healthier and have all these positive attributes because of their work, that in general doing things for other people is a positive thing yeah. in your life? I mean, is that an unreasonable jump to make?
No, not at all. I mean, there are a lot of studies on volunteers.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
People who
yeah.
volunteer are healthier. They have better health outcomes than people who
really?
Don't volunteer. You know, one question is, are you, from the beginning, are you healthy enough in
yep.
order to become a
so
volunteer?
So it's self-selecting potentially.
Yeah, except our studies, the study that just came out, a bunch of other studies do a great job of controlling for baseline health. And
mm-hmm.
we find that even controlling for these health differences at baseline, caregivers do better.
I wonder too whether you know if it matters if someone is working full-time and trying to be a healthcare provider. I would imagine they do better if they're not doing both.
Yeah, so this is just off the cuff. My research doesn't look into that.
Uh-huh.
We basically recruit people who are older and generally retired,
okay.
although also volunteering. You know, it would make sense, wouldn't
yeah.
it, that they're really at high risk because they've got all of the responsibilities from work as well as the family caregiving. There's a lot of data that show that middle-aged people who are caregivers cut down on work. They take leave. Sometimes they quit working. And so, you know, you make lifestyle choices and inevitably those might have downstream effects.
So we only have a minute left, Lisa Fredman. Two quick things. One, what's the moral of the story, if there is one? And what's the next piece of research and the work that you and your colleagues are doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the moral for me is that caregiving is stressful, which is bad in and of itself and very unpleasant. And stress has bad health outcomes. But caregiving itself, aside from the stress, is not going to kill you. We've been doing a lot of research now looking at metabolic syndrome and stress-induced metabolic syndrome in caregivers and non-caregivers. And I think for us, and clearly a lot of the field is going this way, looking at rigorously performed interventions to reduce stress, to address some of these conditions that caregivers develop, like stress-induced metabolic syndrome, you know, would be a really important next step.
Well, thank you for very much. I guess I think we need someone to go caregive to, Jim.
but that is the moral of the story. Is you haven't fixed the stress aspect yet, but the reality is it isn't going to kill you. As you said, it may even make you stronger, which is actually quite wonderful. Lisa Fredman, thanks a lot. That was great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming in, Lisa. And Lisa Fredman is professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at Boston University's School of Public Health. Tomorrow, in a continuing series on You Are Not Alone, we're going to look at the importance of staying healthier longer in our old age as the number of caregivers starts to decline. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to have Deval Patrick in studio for our Ask the Governor segment. So please send your emails in to bpr@wgbh.org. You can call us up tomorrow. Our show is a production of WGBH. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan are our production team. Not easy for me to say anything, actually, which is amazing that I'm on the radio. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you for tuning in.